Hello, and welcome to Hyped, the podcast for the culturally curious that turns a critical eye on some of the most hyped books, plays, films, music, and TV shows of recent years. Join us as we work out where these cultural trends have come from and what they reveal about modern society. I'm Zoe Strimple, a columnist, writer, and historian of gender in modern Britain.
And I'm Tom Stammers. I'm a historian of France and a general cultural glutton with a weakness for all things 19th century. Zoe and I have been consuming and debating culture together ever since we were back at university, which is now indeed so long ago that when we were at university, it feels like the Cindy doll, the sort of unsuccessful British version of Barbie, had just been launched. Did you have a Cindy, Zoe?
No, but I think you're talking about a doll launched in 1965.
1963, the
63.
Cindy.
So it's been a long time that we've been gabbing away. No, I didn't have a Cindy. I didn't even have a Barbie. I was just left, poor child that I am, to play with wooden spoons and pots and pans. So that's the life I had, which might be why I failed slightly to sort of intuit the magic and the allure of Barbie the doll, and to some degree Barbie the movie, but we will get there. So today we are discussing the two kind of major women-y entrants to the Oscars, Barbie and Poor Things.
What we should say straight away is that obviously Barbie is a sort of partial admission to the Oscars, in the sense that the story with Barbie, as we're now on the brink of the Academy Awards, is that it didn't get a nomination for Best Film, Margot Robbie didn't get a nomination for Best Actress, and Greta Gerwig didn't get a nomination for Best Director. So the big story about Barbie recently, and the reason we're starting there, is that the question of a snub, you know, to what extent has kind of Hollywood not recognised the brilliance and the boldness of this film? Zoe, with the benefit of hindsight, here we are on the other side of the massive release, $1.4 billion later. Do you think Barbie, you know, holds up? I mean, has Barbie been mistreated by the Oscars?
I like that you called it sort of I can't remember if it's the story of the snub or the issue of the snub. You know, this is one of those extremely rare cases where I sort of think the Academy is not 100% wrong in having not included it on the list. Now, I do think Barbie deserves, you know, I think it's a very good topic for us to discuss because so many people saw it. So it was, you know, properly that kind of popular success. And I think its messaging was sufficiently interesting and meaty to take it a little bit beyond just like some sort of trashy thing that everybody saw. But I, and Tom, I don't know if this is because you managed to get us tickets to see Barbie with audio captioning, so we could, like it was peculiar.
The only way I enjoy modern cinema now is with
Well, we saw Napoleon with that as well, so thanks. Thanks, Tom. But I think it didn't, you and I thought, or certainly, yeah, I think we both thought, huh, this is sort of more like a sort of very in-your-face series of pastiche kind of, or sort of set pieces or tableau that all speak to sort of different, highly trendified, codified sort of almost memes from the last 10 years or so. So it kind of didn't really work for me as a film. I actually found it quite weird. And I think Greta Gerwig is quite weird. And I think it's very strange and that she was given this kind of incredible free rein to do this film that was quite weird. And actually it's amazing it did as well as it did. So long answer. I think Barbie deserved a lot of critical attention. Do I think it was Oscar worthy, especially next to something like Poor Things? No, probably not. But I have to say, I'm surprised. Greta Gerwig is such a like darling.
Exactly. After Little Women, everyone thought she could do no wrong.
What do you think, Tom? Yeah.
I'm with you. I think a series of set pieces is really all that I'm left with. Actually, I was excited about Barbie before I saw it because I'd seen, like everyone, the trailer. And little did I realize that the trailer indeed had all of the best bits in the film. Like, if you enjoyed the trailer, you've already enjoyed everything that the movie is going to give you. Obviously, we had the Grammys 2 weeks ago. And the one category where Barbie obviously has done very well is in terms of best song. Billie Eilish, Dua Lipa, like a lot of the biggest songs of the year have come off the back of the Barbie soundtrack, which itself is a kind of brilliant confection. But that's because the whole movie really just feels like a music video or a succession of music videos that have been sort of stitched together. Like you, Zoe, I didn't think it managed to make a very coherent point. It had a kind of aesthetic and it had a style, but it didn't really have, I thought, anything particularly meaningful to say about the relation of the sexes or about patriarchy. I thought Ryan Gosling kind of unfortunately was the most kind of alluring and kind of attractive character in it, which if you want to make a movie about female empowerment, something's gone a bit wrong when Ken is the one that people are really talking about and enjoying. And indeed, it's Ryan Gosling who's got the nomination at the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, whereas Margot hasn't. And yeah, I thought it was ironic rather than funny. It felt very 21st century, as you say, like a meme, which you're meant to kind of enjoy in a kind of knowing way. But actually, I didn't really laugh very much. And even the characters that were meant to be funny, like Weird Barbie, the Kate McKinnon character, who I normally love, I didn't actually think was particularly amusing. So yeah, it was a bit, yeah, I thought it was a bit between stools. It wasn't a kind of Melissa McCarthy kind of rompy movie that we would
No,
enjoy
sadly.
laughing at. It sort of took itself a bit too seriously, but it wasn't intellectual enough to actually have anything I thought particularly meaty or interesting to say about, the war of the sexes. So, Barbie for me was a bit sort of between two stools.
I think that irony thing that actually isn't funny to people of our sensibility, and but might have been funny to younger people maybe. But I mean, it is a humor that one sees on. It's a sort of. It is. There was a kind of mirthless humor that kind of was throughout. It's actually amazing, and in a way it's sad. And this is what was clever about Barbie. It is the world that Barbie was sending up slash critiquing, that a feminist film by a woman about a female character that had been constructed by a woman, the Oscar nomination goes to the man playing Ken, whose role is to, basically say misogynistic truths about patriarchy when he escapes into the real world. Like, it's amazing. Men run everything here. And so the kind of ironies, if the film kind of is ironic, the ironies about its points do kind of continue or have continued into real life. And I do think that's a little bit excruciating. And I actually don't agree with you that Ken was all that likable or interesting. I actually
Well,
thought,
the self-pity of Ken, I suppose, was a kind of was one of the more
yeah,
humorous
but you know what? It's
moments.
too close to the bone, because we see too many of these pathetic men who are actually really quite violent and worrying, like the incels or the MAGA crowd, or in a way, my sympathies for like the self-doubting, self-loathing, angry, disenfranchised loser male is somewhat limited, because they've just one too many times taken a shotgun, and mown people down. I mean, Tom, what didn't you and I also didn't like particularly, or tell me if I'm wrong, that interlude when they kind of run off with America Ferrera's character and her really bratty daughter. What did you make of that?
No, I did not think this was a very endearing portrait of Generation Z. Gen Z did not come out well to me. And in fact, maybe you know this, though, America Ferrera has also been nominated for Best Supporting
I
Actress.
saw
I
that. Yeah.
mean, insane,
Weird.
insane, on
Makes no
very
sense.
strange,
Yeah.
very strange. And I'm very much hoping she's not going to get the recognition. And the same goes for Ryan Gosling as well. I mean, one thing I'd say as well, though, is you said kind of the critique that the movie presents. Does it really ever manage to land any blows? I thought it was such a shiny pro-Mattel kind of movie that obviously this has been made with the company. And yes, it's got a sense of distance perhaps from some of the old tropes that Barbie went hand in hand with and some of the, the more regressive aspects of girls playing with dolls and reinforcing gender norms. But actually, this is all about, encouraging people to buy Mattel products. And so I thought it had very, very little critical distance. It was like reclaiming Barbie as something that's always been on the side of like women's imagination and women's play. And you've got the kind of stale male guys in the boardroom, but really this is a movie that's lockstep with kind of big shiny corporate merchandising. So yeah, I didn't think it managed to land any blows.
See, I that's interesting, because I did want to ask you what you thought of the feminist messaging, because Tom, let's face it, you know a lot about feminism, and indeed most of my feminist book collection is a gift. So, but I actually thought the send, but there was that real send up of the actual executives in the Mattel building. So I thought it actually did quite a good job of separating the kind of ludicrous masculinism of the company, kind of trying to come up with this ever stupider, more subservient Barbie, these idiot men, and then when the real Barbie comes in and represents, you know, the women's wide-ranging imagination, it there's the sort of quite a kind of clash. But I thought in terms of the messaging and the feminist, the sophistication or the interest of the feminist messaging, that's where I think the blows failed to land. Because I think we, you know, it was actually just quite crude sort of girl power separatism where, you know, you in the end, the happy ending is that all the women are back literally filling every single post and the men are all back being kind of just eye candy. But we that's not even a reflection of, you know, the inverse of society now in the West at all, you know, either. So I don't know, I just thought it was a little crude, you know, saying women are better and men should, you know, just be eye candy because they're stupid and whatever. And, you know, but I'm
I
not.
felt it couldn't decide whether it thought kind of that sex and gender itself as a construct was mischievous and wrong, like that the idea of kind of women and men was kind of, you know, was oppressive. But then it didn't actually manage to go into a very queer kind of realm. It ended up reinforcing the idea of women are like this and men are like that. And it never really gets out of that binary, even though it shows you that the gender roles that have been constructed around those sexes are kind of ludicrous and sometimes oppressive. It doesn't really have another way of cutting beyond men and women because the non-Ken male is pathetic. Alan, you know, the man who's not Ken, the man who's not eye candy, is pitiful. He's not a kind of progressive character. And equally, the women who are not kind of beautiful and fun are just, you know, weird Barbies, etc., are not given a kind of rival space that they can inhabit. So, yeah, I think it ended up being quite binary, even while it's trying to go beyond binary.
And not only that, but it's like, okay, you can say, oh, I'm the president, you know, I'm Black Barbie, and I'm, you know, not that she called Black Barbie, but she kept saying like, oh, you know, Supreme Court justices, president, engineers, they're all sort of different, this Barbie, that Barbie. But like, no, that's the whole problem with real life. There's no, you know, the problem we have is that just saying like, I'm the president is sort of fun and sexy in a film, but it glosses over something actually quite painful, which is what Sheryl Sandberg, the much maligned Sheryl Sandberg, is always trying to say, which is that women essentially aren't fulfilling, aren't doing these powerful roles, and they aren't justices as much, and they aren't in mathematicians, and they aren't scientists, and they aren't engineers. And you, good luck to you trying to find a female electrician. It's a utopia of female involvement in male fields that isn't there, but it just jumped to sort of, that's what I mean by the sort of girl power thing where it's like, oh, if we just have some glossy, oh, I'm a judge, you know, but no, but there's a real sort of, that's the real problem with what's going on in the West. And it was a bit like it just jumped over that to make another point, which I think was a bit regressive. Tom, what would you say, okay, using your historical knowledge,
Please historicize Ruth Handler.
well, yeah, I what period do you think this film's feminism fell into?
It's very actually a very interesting question. I felt it probably was a weird combination of the 1950s and the 2020s. Like, I feel like it's a movie that's completely about now, but where its ideas about kind of gender fixity did seem, you know, very mid-20th century, like Betty Friedan, dare I say. I wonder, I don't know, it did feel like it was of a it was not very subtle and not very nuanced, and there was nothing, as I say, going on between, like, the space between the sexes was had not been very thoughtfully populated. So yeah, it felt kind of crude and finger waggy in lots of ways. And you're right to say, actually, this thing about Black Barbie, I think that's the thing. You've got the kind of caricature of the board, you know, the bad old days when the board was all men. But then clearly the movie is also a celebration of different types of women, different body shapes, different ethnicities. And there Mattel has got it covered. So actually the pro-diversity message is one that's completely compatible with the kind of consumerist fantasy of Barbie. Indeed, Joe, my partner, recently had to buy some Barbies for his nieces, and he bought disabled Barbie, Black Barbie, and And these are for, white kids in Georgia. But
What about
actually, the
in
range of
Europe?
Barbies that are now available is extraordinary. Like
I
neurodiverse
was going to say, do they
Barbie.
have neurodiverse Barbie?
I think they may have neurodiverse Barbie. Wheelchair Barbie is definitely
Autistic
one.
Barbie, yeah.
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 I mean, it is quite amazing. There's no Barbie product that cannot be commodified. So it's an interesting phenomenon, which in this question about sex and gender, I guess, is a nice pivot for thinking about Poor Things, which is also in a way a reflection on the difference or different ideas about femininity. And also the un I mean, there's something that you said, Zoe, is very interesting, is that it's another movie about woman as doll
Yeah.
in a strange way. It's
Cyborg.
another cyborg.
Yeah.
Do you want to say something about women and cyborgs, Zoe? Because I know you're a keen reader of Donna Haraway, and I
Oh,
wonder whether that's a lens onto this whole discussion.
yeah, I was sort of dreading. I suddenly thought, oh God, I hope Tom doesn't ask me to kind of like gloss Haraway and the females and the cyborg manifesto. But I think she was almost making a feminist point that ultimately women will kind of become, or machines will become extensions of women, and women will become extensions of machines, and there'll be a sort of empowerment that within. But I mean, her point is so weird and wacky that actually that may not be accurate, but I think that's what I took from it.
Yeah. Women as the post-human, that there will be an
Yes.
outstripping of kind of almost, if women have been restricted by biology, the future is a kind of post-biological woman.
Exactly. And the internet, obviously, a lot of internet theory drew on Haraway's cyborg ideas, and it's about that sort of post-embodiment. And I think, I suppose Barbie's a doll, and the character of Poor Things is a sort of is a Frankenstein's monster.
Yes.
And so neither of them are human women, and neither of them live in real worlds. Barbie's living in this weird Barbie world, and which doesn't even pretend to be, they take one little trip into the real world, which they get to by driving a car along a road that's, I mean, it's not the
Which
real.
is the best bit in the film? The kind
Yeah.
of the collision of realities is the best
Yes.
thing in the film.
It's
Yeah.
interesting that. And then Poor Things is also kind of this strange, he really overhypes it. There's the kind of like fisheye lens and the black and white that suddenly eventually yields to color, and the fact that Poor Things, she's dragged out of the Thames by this weird scientist, and then is given her pregnant her, she's pregnant with a fetus. The fetus's brain is put in her brain, and then she, it's none of this has any bearing on really. So I do wonder if that's our cyborg moment. We've kind of lost interest in women, flesh and blood women, and so it's, we've had, we're going to this ultra archetyped, sort of stylized domain. But what's interesting is that the critical reaction to Poor Things has been so fantastic, and I think it was a really good film. I don't know, Tom, what do you think is the most interesting kind of way of contrasting Barbie and Poor Things' success and hype?
Yeah, so obviously, Poor Things is never going to achieve the commercial success of Barbie, but it has, won every, all of the kind of critical adulation. We should just say, for the benefit of people listening, for those who don't know, Poor Things is the new movie by Yorgos Lanthimos. I might be mangling that pronunciation, who is the controversial Greek director who did The Favourite, obviously a movie that lots of people love, but also did a bunch of movies that Zoe and I have not enjoyed previously, like The Lobster and Killing of a Sacred Deer. So he's divisive, but he is seen as an auteur. He's, in a way that Greta Gerwig is still making movies that are box office.
Yeah.
Yorgos Lanthimos is occasionally making box office movies, but they're movies that sort of accidentally stray into box office, but really has got the sensibilities of a European art house director. The fascinating thing about Poor Things is it's based on a Scottish novel by Alistair Gray, which is written in 1992. So again, just as Barbie is a kind of vision of the relation between the sexes that looks back to, the 1950s and subsequently, this also is a film that feels very, very much of the current moment, but is also informed by debates that have been going on within feminist and Marxist circles in the 1970s and 80s about the sexes, but also about capitalism. Like, this is a movie that is much more politically, I think it's much more politically loaded and is much more politically explosive than Barbie, which is ultimately a big kind of shiny sales pitch. I do think this is an interesting movie about how a woman might achieve liberation for herself, and where she's going to achieve liberation really by becoming the godlike father. It's a Frankenstein story again, that she will take the place at the end of her father, but she will do it only by kind of escaping from all of the illusions about what womanhood should be. So Emma Stone, who plays Bella, the lead character, is completely anti-feminine. You know, she is almost like woman in her most natural state, where there is no like gender construction to contain her. Like, she does not act in any decorous female appropriate ways. She is instead a kind of like an animal woman, in kind of very interesting ways, which means she's got an incredibly she's very rude, she's kind of coarse, she doesn't have a sense of being kind of polite and dainty, but she's also got appetites. Like, and it's a very interesting reflection on female sexuality, which is a thing that Alistair Gray was writing about a lot. Barbie is completely sexless. Barbie has no sexual appetite, whereas Bella has a completely de-eroticized but very powerful libido, I thought, that was actually very interesting. Sorry.
No, I was just saying, I completely agree. I was going to say that Barbie's completely sexless, and of course has no genitalia.
Absolutely.
And whereas Bella, you know, discovers what pleasure her genitalia can bring, and then of course thinks she's going to, you know, deploy that pleasure at all times and places, including at the dinner table. But Tom, I was going to say, what, you know, one of the, because Barbie's sexless, there's no, the sort of feminine, maybe the reason the Barbie feminism felt a little bit regressive or dated was because it wasn't really about sex. It was about women as professionals, or women being taken seriously as humans, or, you know, women, can women be beautiful and play with Barbies but also be executives? Whereas Bella eventually goes straight for the jugular by deciding to become a prostitute and experience.
She becomes her own means of production, I think she says at one point. You know, it's a weirdly Marxist sense of kind of, in a world where everything's for sale, why not sell yourself? And again, because she's got no feminine inhibitions, she's like, why not? This is just rational capitalism in a way.
But I mean,
and it's quite a celebratory account. Like, her account in the brothel, again, there's no moralism about it. She's completely amoral. We're meant to celebrate it.
I think that's what's great about it. It's one of the first depictions I've seen of it. She does not seem to be used and abused. She's doing it to get an experience. She's good at it. She gets the money. She enjoys buying eclairs with the money. She makes friends with the other girl there, who actually, they are going to kind of socialist circles. But I just wondered, Tom, what you think of the fact that Yorgos went, you know, it was an interesting way to take on the sexed but not feminized woman, but to make her a prostitute and then encounter her companion's horror and disgust that she'd gone off and earned some money by sleeping with someone else. And she didn't understand why he thought that, you know, she said, now you're going to tell me that's all wrong, and I don't understand why, kind of thing. And so there's a sort of sexual morality point there, which, you know, I don't know. I found that
process. Well, she and her father are completely amoral characters. Her and God, you know, yeah, the experimenter, the scientist, operate outside of human morality. And
no,
like both...
I disagree. No.
Well, maybe outside of human morality, but they fundamentally are in tune with the body. They've got scientific understandings of their own biology,
kind.
I suppose.
They're kind. They're not violent.
No, they're kind.
Yeah. So that means that I think that, to me, made the film interesting, because they weren't sort of amoral, because I think amoral,
yes,
very quickly is monstrous and cruel. And
yeah,
Bella's,
okay, that's probably...
Yeah.
That's probably fair, Zoe. I suppose when you say amoral, I suppose what I probably mean is that there's not much Christian morality, let's say. They're not worried about respectability. They're not worried about decorum in that sense. And the thing they have in common, in a different way, he's a scientist and she's a prostitute, but both of them are interested in the body and a kind of honesty about the body. There's no prudery. There's no taboo in that sense. And I think that's the thing that they have in common. And that's the thing that's interesting, because so many of the other men in the film then get very anxious about bodies and ownership of bodies and what you should do with bodies and how you should clothe or not clothe bodies, how bodies should comport themselves. Whereas her and her father, in their different ways, are completely progressive on the body. Like, they have no sense of restriction.
Yes, I think that is true. But I think what kind of makes that less seedy is that there's a genuine sort of scientific open-mindedness,
yes,
kind of man is born free and is everywhere in chains, except these ones aren't in chains, or they try to resist the chains. And you see, you know, the vision is actually quite nice. And then, you know, there's that strange bit that at the end, you know, where it veers off into yet another strange episode where the person she was engaged to before she, well, maybe this is too much spoiler, do you think?
You say a little bit about it. That, like, there are these other men that she uses at different points, one of whom sentimentally, some of whom sexually, but she's constantly using the men for her own advantage. And the men think that they can use her, but then they realize quite quickly that she's much more consistent. You know, she's much more fearless than them.
Yeah. Yes, but there it's worse than that though, Tom, because basically she exposes men, apart from the, you know, there's one kind one, and then there's God, her father, God short for Goddard. And then there's the immensely cruel, barbarian, misogynist who she was supposed to get married to.
The Mark Ruffalo. Oh, the Mark Ruffalo
No.
she was gonna elope. Oh, at the end,
Yes,
the final
that
man.
one.
Yes.
And the Ruffalo, and basically you don't really see these men who do stand on ceremony and do appear to be highly socialized. You know, they end up being barbarian. So I think, you know, you don't leave this film thinking, you know, romantic relationships with men are is generally a very good idea. And I think it, yeah, it's just nice that in the end she returns to a love of bodies, but in a science way.
Absolutely.
And
And
that's
it's
it.
almost like a Garden of Eden at the end, kind of
Yeah.
explicitly. She's, you know, she's assumed the position of Father God and she's creating her own kingdom. She's improving nature. But in a way, again, where there's, you know, she's remaking biology. And I think the thing you point out, though, which is entirely right, is even a lot of the sex, because it's filmed in a completely de-eroticized way. I mean, there's tons of sex in the film, but it's not sexy because sex for her is about knowledge. She's doing this stuff to understand things about her own body and understand things about the world. You know, it's a way of thinking about, oh, like the monster in Frankenstein. She's trying to learn something about the outside world.
Well, Tom, do you think it should have won? Do you think it should win an Oscar or two or three?
No, I actually, this is to wind it up. Actually, you were saying that there's no appetite now for real fleshy women. So I think the two best female performances this year, I would like Emma Stone to win. But if she doesn't win for Poor Things, the other film, which I know you haven't seen, Zoe, but I think is incredible, is Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon. And the female actress in that, the Native American actress, Lily Gladstone, is superlative. And it's an interesting movie because she is pretty much the only woman in a movie that is full of evil men. And so in a way, you know, it's another way of thinking about how, you know, how women fit into narratives in the 21st century. But she is the moral center in a movie that is full of otherwise completely disgusting men.
But I find that so regressive and depressing, Tom. And especially as I've been watching a lot of TV recently, that has also just been the odd moral woman in a sea of absolutely disgusting men, who are disgusting phys you know, in all sorts of ways, vulgar, crude, misogynistic, violent. You know, it's very interesting how snagged on gender with women as this and men as that we still are, and how stylized that is, because, you know, we can have a sort of Handmaid's Tale where it's all about women being, you know, revolutionary or otherwise, or we can have, you know, there are other sort of extremes where the women are all sort of evil. But it's very rare these days, it feels like, just to have a film where there's kind of, or TV series where there's sort of like men and women in it together who aren't entirely characterized according to the moral associations with their sex, don't you think? Aren't we
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think a lot of that is to do with lazy pop feminism in the present, and I'll come back to that in a minute. What I would say in defense of this Scorsese film, I mean, I've slightly over simplified there. What's very interesting about her and the Leonardo DiCaprio character, and he definitely is a bad person and she primarily is a good person, is that nonetheless it's very interesting and how these people kind of rely on each other and how far she's complicit in her own degradation. It is a very depressing film, but it's about a very depressing subject. It's about the you know, the making of the American West in the 1920s and the destruction of Indian communities and the Osage and so on. It's grim. It's grim. It's a story about greed and evil that is 3.5 hours long, and you do come away feeling quite bleak about the makings of America. But I think it's a very powerful film. But what's interesting is that she knows that these people are destroying her, and she knows the kind of threat that they pose, and yet there's a way in which she you know, she's still willing to give them the benefit of the doubt, or that she can sort of, with her eyes open, she goes to her own destruction. So there's something about the weird resignation and suffering and passivity, while also with nobility, that's really interesting in it. But it is a very different, as you say, it's a different way of stylizing the kind of the suffering woman as an old trope about how women used to be represented, you know, the kind of moral center in the storm, versus the completely, as you say, kind of amoral revolutionary woman that is Bella. But they're still both quite stark. And I think there is a problem that there's so much attention on female representation and women's writing that it means that there's almost too much concern to kind of stylize it in a particular way. And I find a lot of drama really dumb in terms of, like, as you say, the kind of the female empowerment narrative really bores me.
No, but it's interesting you say that. I'm finding that there's not very much. There's women who are swamped in, like, huge landscapes, seas, tsunamis of aggressive men. So it's funny. I actually don't. I would have thought there'd be more explicit female empowerment, but instead, it feels like people are sort of just giving up. I mean, I was watching The Tourist, which is quite fun on BBC One. Again, men, violent men, drug dealing men, extremely horrible, scary people, gun happy, murder happy. And I was looking, the writers are literally all men. The director's a man.
Interesting.
It's not that, that's not Hollywood, but it's that, I don't know.
I think you're seeing more of the female empowerment maybe is back in the popular genres. And I think it's sort of interesting. I mean, I watched a Marvel movie last week, the Marvels, you know, and it's interesting. More and more of these superhero movies are all female. Yeah. You know, you're certainly getting much more like the all-female Ghostbusters. You know, there is an attempt to reboot the kind of hero movie as a kind of all-female collective.
Yes, but the gulf, the gap between that, which always feels so fake, because it's just, let's make those heroes female, and the storylines that grab people still about rape and murder and disembodiment, this dismemberment of women, the gap is like, it's just unbridgeable, it seems.
Yeah.
But I kind of wondered if post-Me Too, there was something about a sort of renewed interest in the darkness of male sexuality, which does seem to kind of be everywhere. And Emma Stone, I heard her give an interview on Fresh Air, which is the NPR podcast, culture podcast, and she was so thoughtful and so intelligent.
She's so brilliant. I think she's so clever.
She was so wonderful to listen to. And, you know, she didn't really delve into the, she did delve into the gender politics, I suppose, of Poor Things, but it did make me think, okay, so there is room for like a really intelligent reflection on women and feminization and sexuality and bodies. And it's interesting that is getting acclaim, I suppose, because I'm surprised, given that people love Squid Game and they love, you know, as you say, the Killer Moon, the kinds of stories. And I don't know, there seems to still be space for intelligent explorations of female identity, maybe.
And it comes back to this question about who's telling the stories. And, you know, in an era of more and more female directors, I think there's scope again for, you know, hopefully more nuanced representations. I mean, two other performances we should, you know, wrap up, but with two other performances to flag this year that have obviously been much, much admired. Carey Mulligan is another version in Maestro. But the other, in terms of a female filmmaker this year, Past Lives, which we saw together, Zoe, which I thought was kind of brilliant, did have quite a nuanced representation of the female lead character there. I thought that was, and that's by a female filmmaker, and I thought did, you know, did show that there's a whole emotional terrain there that is really ripe for more exploration.
Oh, see, I thought Past Lives was very thin, thin little slip of a film.
I thought very suggestive. You're right to say it doesn't spell it out, but it has, you know, it visually infers things. And, you know, you can feel that the actors are kind of thinking, I felt the actors are kind of saying more through their gestures and their bodies than they're articulating. The script, I agree with you, is deliberately underwritten. And then there's the nature of the relationships is all the more mysterious because of it. Another great female character, Lady Macbeth.
Lady Macbeth.
Indeed, we're thinking about women in a men's world again.
I know. Well, Tom and I are supposed to go and see Macbeth with Ralph Fiennes, no less, much hyped. So hence perfect for hyped production. So that will be one of our next ones. But I think Maestro will also be muscling in.
Because it's good to think about classical music on screen as well. It's a very interesting question about how do you tell the story of classical music in a kind of box office way? And, you know, what does artistic inspiration look like? I mean, I don't want to poison your views, Zoe, but there are some, I think, cringy sequences. But yeah, you will enjoy.
Okay, yes, I'm looking forward to it. Okay, well, join us next time for Macbeth with Ralph Fiennes and or Heart on a Field, Maestro. Wow.
I don't think we're going to try and find a sandwich where those two things live together. Or maybe.
That's a tricky sandwich.